My guest today, Gareth Porter, is an independent investigative journalist and historian specializing in U.S. national security policy and institutions. He has been a regular contributor to Interpress Service since 2004 and has published longer investigative articles in The Nation, Salon, Truthout, and Raw Story. His analysis also appear regularly in Al Jazeera English. He is author of Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and The Road to War in Vietnam, published by the University of California. We first spoke with him in October 2009, and then in June and December of 2010, and January last year. On each occasion, when I opened the phones toward the end of the hour, the lights on the board were lit up with your calls, and you'll have a chance to do that again later in the show. But now, welcome once again, Gareth Porter, to Takes on the World. I was going to say more than a year has passed since the last time we spoke, and the push towards a war in Iran, at the very least bringing the country to its knees, persists on the part of the same players. In fact, the election of a new president, Hassan Rouhani, who is portrayed as a moderate, the very opposite of Ahmadinejad, has been viewed by the warmongers from Netanyahu to AIPAC as a serious threat to their goals. What's your take on his election and their response?
Well, first of all, Rouhani is, I think the significance of his election is extremely far-reaching. It has to be understood that Rouhani is the equivalent of all of the national security advisors as well as secretaries of state in the United States over like a 20-year period. He has personally held the key position in Iranian national security policy since 1989 until 2005 when Ahmadinejad took over. He was the so-called secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, and that gave him really the pivotal position in terms of conceiving of and essentially carrying out Iranian national security policy. He is a representative of one of the two major points of view in Iranian foreign policy over the last two and a half decades. One of those two points of view is represented by Ahmadinejad, and that is a sort of extreme nationalist, not just anti-American, anti-Western, but really wanting to keep Iran separate and essentially unattached to the global economy, and favoring a much more non-market approach to the internal economic structure and functioning of Iran, whereas the second tendency, which Rouhani is really a key member of, has been one that really sees Iran as necessarily being part of the global economy, being integrated into the global economy in order to reach its potential, both in terms of its domestic economy and in terms of its role in the region. So the objective of Rouhani and his patron, Hashemi Rafsanjani, the former president of Iran, has long been to reach a deal with the United States. This has been the case for two decades and more. And that's why his election is extremely favorable to getting what I call the second chance for the West and for the United States to make the kind of deal with Iran that they could have made in 2003 to 2005, but failed to do so because the Bush administration was simply not interested in any agreement with Iran. They were interested only in regime change. So in a nutshell, I think that is the significance of Rouhani now coming to power. It gives the United States and the West a second chance for a broad agreement with Iran that could end this unnatural state of hostility between the United States and Iran, which, by the way, is now going on its fourth decade, and it bids fair to really outlast the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union in terms of its of the length that this has gone on.
But the question remains, is the president, and let's say President Obama, who just seems to be reluctant to initiate a war, has been reluctant even to push for some of the the draconian sanctions. How free is he to act when you have a three-quarters, of more than three-quarters of the House, and you virtually, well, the entire Senate, calling for even more draconian sanctions and endorsing, in essence, military strike on Iran if Iran doesn't knuckle under to the U.S. Demands. And clearly, there were statements in the Jewish press and the Israeli press, the election of Rouhani was a disaster because Ahmadinejad, as one AIPAC president once said, was the gift that keeps on giving.
Right.
And Rouhani has such a different image that he presents a real threat to their achievement. Can Washington actually act? Can the Obama administration actually act with a majority of Congress not behind him?
That, of course, is the question of the hour, the day, the week, the month, and the year. And I think there are two answers to that question. The first answer is that if you had a president with some cojones, I think the answer is that yes, a president who is willing to lead the American people by using the bully pulpit and being a truth teller could push back against this tide of Israeli influence, I think it's fair to say control, over the both houses of Congress, and make it difficult for members of Congress to continue to do what they've been doing, which is to kowtow to the Israeli lobby. The second answer is the reality, of course, is that our present president does not have the cojones to do that. He's not shown it in any major national security foreign policy issue so far. On the contrary, I think what he has shown is that his automatic response to situations where he's confronted with very powerful lobbies on behalf of, I mean, the two most powerful lobbies in American politics are the military-industrial complex and the Israeli lobby. And he has shown that he's unwilling to buck either one of those so far. The answer, therefore, I think, is in reality that he's not going to do it, that he's going to continue the general policy of not going any farther in negotiations with the Iranians than the Israeli lobby is willing to allow him to go. And this, by the way, reminds me that in my trip, during my trip to Tehran in December of 2008, after the election of Obama, I was interested primarily in finding out how the Iranians basically approached the whole question of the new administration and how hopeful they were of being able to make a deal with Obama. And what I found was that there were two schools of thought within the Iranian government. There were those who still had some hope that perhaps Obama could achieve a degree of freedom from the lobby based on his having won a mandate during the election campaign for a diplomatic engagement with Iran, having run on that platform. And a second point of view, which was that no, he's really in the control, in the clutches of the Israeli lobby. And I was also told, and by the way, I was there when Hillary Clinton was named as Secretary of State. And as soon as that happened, there was an immediate response in terms of that debate within the Iranian leadership strata. Those who were hopeful became much less hopeful, and those who were unconvinced that Obama could have the freedom to make a deal were more certain than ever that that was the case. So I think that well before Obama took office, the Iranians were quite clear that he did not have the freedom of action. And that's why what I've learned in recent months is that when Obama sent a letter to the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei in the first months of his presidency. I think it was in May, if I remember correctly. Khamenei's response was, sure, as long as the United States is ready to demonstrate that it is not just simply going to continue its past and present policy of hostility toward Iran, now, meaning that it's time for the United States to show through some gesture of concession to Iran by at least removing some sanctions, for example, that it is ready to change its policy. And of course, that's something the administration of Barack Obama was not willing to do. And so I think the Iranians drew the logical conclusion that that their only option really was to continue to try to build a position of strength to negotiate at some later date with the United States when the United States was ready to change its policy.
This doesn't really seem likely. It's interesting, what most Americans aren't really aware of is that not only these sanctions, draconian sanctions in the full meaning of that word, against Iran, but they are also written to sanction any country, including allies, that violate these sanctions. And there's constant pressure being put on companies around the world. There's an organization called United Against Nuclear Iran,
right,
that is constantly sending demands of corporations around the world to stop doing business with Iran, threatening letters. And this has been very successful, although I was just reading the other day that India, desperately in need in terms of its economy, is going to make an oil deal with Iran, and this is going to put pressure on the United States on how to deal with that. Have you seen that in the papers?
I've not seen that specific story, but I was certainly aware in the past that there was a lot of tension within India over precisely this issue, because it is clearly in their economic interest to make arrangements with Iran to import Iranian oil, and this is there's certainly very powerful interests within the Indian economy and politics, excuse me, who felt very strongly that this would be a huge mistake for India to go along with the boycott of Iranian oil that was being pushed by the United States and its European allies.
Well, there must be tremendous resentment around the world that the U.S. Congress, in essence, the Israel lobby, is deciding the foreign policy for every country in the world regarding Iran.
Well, I think to the extent that analysts in other countries do understand the realities of American national security policy and domestic politics, they certainly do have that view that that this is an unnatural and really very intrusive on the interests of the rest of the world, that the United States is pursuing a policy that is in no one's interest really except for Israel's, and that is a sorry state for the United States and for the rest of the world to be in.
Now, I'm wondering, last week there was a secret trip made to Israel by the General Welsh, the head of the Air Force, which was published in the Israeli press and American Jewish press. And this week, General Martin Dempsey, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has been in Israel conferring with his counterparts there. Do you think they're supposedly talking about all the various issues, Egypt, Syria, and so on, and Iran? Do you think there's any connection, or how do you view these trips?
Well, I would differentiate between the Air Force general going to Israel and Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think their interests are quite distinct from one another. The Air Force has long been, of all the U.S. military services, the one that has been most closely associated with the Israeli military, and the one that has been most willing to contemplate war against Iran. I think the reasons are obvious. A war against Iran would be an Air Force war, and it is the invariable rule of bureaucratic politics with regard to the U.S. national security state, that the bureaucracy that has the biggest interest at stake, the biggest positive role in any particular policy, is going to be in favor of that policy. So when you've had in the past proposals for war against Iran, specifically in 2007 when Vice President Dick Cheney was proposing that the United States try to trigger a war with Iran by carrying out an airstrike on Iranian territory in supposedly in retaliation against some kind of operation in Iraq, which killed American troops that they could blame on Iran, you had primarily a negative response from the Pentagon officials, the civilian officials of the Pentagon, as well as the uniformed military leadership. But of all the military services, it was the Air Force that has been most willing to contemplate war against Iran because it would be their war, and they feel quite positive that they could do a good job, and therefore why not? But I think their position was essentially drowned out by a chorus of very loud no's on the part of the rest of the military and civilian leadership at the Pentagon. And that's why I think that Martin Dempsey, representing that consensus on the part of most military services and civilians at the Pentagon, was there not to encourage the Israelis, but to tell them no, as he has in past trips, and I believe he's done so with the encouragement of Obama himself. I mean, clearly Obama does not want a war because not simply because it would be a disaster for the U.S. economy and for him politically, but because the military-industrial complex itself is not in favor of a war with Iran. And so I think Dempsey was there just to continue to pass that message to the Israelis. I don't think that it had to do with any step towards war at all. And in fact, I think that the best way to think about U.S. policy at this point is that the real war that is at stake here is, in fact, the economic sanctions being waged, being organized against Iran. I mean, they are, in effect, an act of war against Iran by any measure, by any traditional definition of that concept. And I think that is what, in fact, the Israelis have really wanted all along. The Israelis have been talking about war against Iran, but that's really a phony threat. It always was a phony threat under Netanyahu and his predecessor as well. What they really were doing was using the threat of war to try to push the United States and European countries, as well as Russia and China, into supporting the kinds of sanctions that they have now carried out, that the United States and the Europeans have carried out.
Well, it's interesting you point out that the sanctions are, in fact, a form of warfare, which in any other circumstances, if Iran was a major military power and had an inclination to go to war, would be justified in responding. But this is never a discussion on the table. There's also the connection. Israel is still stinging from their inability to defeat Hezbollah in Lebanon in 2006 and had to withdraw from Lebanon in 2000 after sustaining a number of casualties, many more than were reported in the paper. And it seems that one of Israel's targets at the same time is Hezbollah, and this is why they have launched attacks on Syria. Maybe you could. How do you frame that whole network?
Right. I think you're right that the Israelis still target, in a sense, Hezbollah. That the Israeli military, the IDF, would love to be able to have another crack at Hezbollah if, in fact, they could do so without too heavy casualties and be assured of success. The problem is, I think, that they don't have that kind of confidence. They can't have that kind of confidence for the simple reason that that Hezbollah today has 5 to 10 times more rockets and 5 to 10 times more capacity to inflict serious damage on Israeli civilian society than it did before the 2006 Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And so that's why I think the Israelis have not attacked Hezbollah or attacked Lebanon in an effort to seriously weaken Hezbollah, as they talked about doing ever since the what was recognized generally within Israel as a defeat in the 2006 war. The balance of forces, the balance of power is simply unfavorable to Israel at this point, too unfavorable to allow for another attack against Hezbollah. And that's why they are, of course, trying to prevent Iran from being able to reinforce Hezbollah through Syria. They have attacked targets within Syria that they claim were, in fact, rockets on their way through Syria from Iran to Lebanon. I'm not familiar with the intelligence on this, but I assume that they probably did, in fact, believe that that's what they were hitting, whether that was the case or not. And the problem that the Israelis face in Syria is that they would like to see Iran and Hezbollah weakened by a change of regime that would be now unfriendly to those parties. But at the same time, they understand that there's a serious risk attached to that. If they were to have regime change in Syria, it's most likely that the new regime would be one dominated or friendly or open to the influence of jihadists. And certainly not only no friends of Israel, but most likely jihadists who would cause serious problems for Israeli security and perhaps much more serious problems than they would have with the status quo. So my view is that the Israelis don't really want regime change in Syria, that they are carrying out some sporadic attacks in Syria for the sake of, for sort of tell their own people that they're doing something about the situation, but that this is simply not going to change the overall situation, which is that Hezbollah is going to remain a very strong foe, which prevents Israel from ever again exercising the kind of influence that they did in the past in Lebanon.
What degree or extent do you think that Israel's trying to foment a Sunni-Shia war, not just in Iraq, perhaps, but also in Lebanon? We see.
Yes, I think that is an Israeli aim. Divide, and if not conquer, at least dominate. To divide and dominate, perhaps, is the best way to think about this. In fact, I was just reading an essay written by an Israeli back in the 1980s that talked about a strategy for Israel in the Middle East, which was to reduce the major states, meaning Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, to smaller states, to basically divide them up on the basis of ethnicity and sectarian, of course, sectarian differences within those countries. So that has long been an Israeli strategy. They take advantage of every opportunity to try to divide and weaken their Arab neighbors. And certainly Syria invites that at this point. But again, I mean, for every advantage that they might feel that they can derive from this policy, there are risks attached to it as well. And I think that in the case of Syria, those two points are finely balanced at this point. Even though they like to see Arabs fighting against one another, to the extent that Al-Qaeda is taking advantage of it to build increasingly a strong position in both Syria as well as in Lebanon, it certainly does pose risks for Israel. So in the end, I'm not sure what it gets Israel in terms of real security.
My guest is Gareth Porter. We're talking about Iran. Yes, I'm familiar with that pamphlet by Oded Inan was his name.
Exactly, yes, right. That's the one, yeah.
And it's when you see what is happening in the Middle East, three decades after he wrote that, it seems like a prescription, a formula that Israel designed to weaken its enemies. On the other hand, I recall Ben-Gurion in his early days saying that it was important to keep tension on the border because Israel could not afford to make peace with its Arab enemies because then Israel would become slovenly and the Arab countries would then overrun them.
Yeah.
And they used to have Israeli soldiers fire at Syrian officers across the border in Syria to, quote, heat up the border. And in 1983, when I was interviewing an Israeli soldier who was stationed in the Golan, he said, he told me that they would have Israeli soldiers in 1983, this is maybe before the Lebanon War, during the Lebanon War, fire at at Syrians to heat up the border. And he used the exact expression that Ben-Gurion had used in English, mm-hmm. but wasn't even aware of the history of that expression.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Israel is playing a game that I once asked an Israeli writer, Richard Ben Kramer, what would happen if Israel would make peace, however, would make peace with all its Arab neighbors and would not be perceived as a threat? What would happen to the Israel lobby? He said it would evaporate like a balloon, losing air. So
correct. And of course, there are voices in Israel, I think, increasingly, who are pointing out the serious challenge to not just the security of Israel, but the very existence of Israel as a Jewish state from the past and present policies that are being pursued with regard to the Palestinians. That this, in the view of many, including, the former head of Mossad, this is a formula that poses very extreme risks to the very idea of Israel. So, I mean, I think they're still a very small minority. Let me make it clear. I don't think that they hold political sway within Israeli politics. But you do begin to hear more serious voices and not, not traditional doves. Meir Dagan, of course, is no dove in his view of either Palestinians or Iran. He's taken as hard a line as anybody, except for the idea of attacking Iran, which he says is ridiculous. It's the stupidest idea he's ever heard. But you hear these voices now saying that it's been a serious strategic mistake on Netanyahu's part to refuse to move forward on creating a Palestinian state. And I think that's going to continue to be a growing theme in Israeli politics.
Well, now, of course, we see this farce, this latest chapter of the so-called peace process, peace talks, in which, once again, the Palestinians are meeting Israelis without a lawyer present, as they were at Oslo. And you have actually this day-to-day cooperation with the Palestine Authority in Israel suppressing Palestinian resistance. It seems like a good reason why Palestinians on the ground have no faith that this is going to lead to anything for them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is a process that was dead not just upon arrival, but before arrival. Again, I think that there's a growing consensus between Israelis and Palestinians that the two-state solution is close to being dead. This is as a result of the power of the settler lobby in Israel, represented by the Likud party, and the complicated politics of Israel. It seems impossible to move Israel away from this course of removing any possibility for a genuine Palestinian state. And, of course, this government has no intention of allowing any state whatsoever to arise, a Palestinian state to arise, within the territory of Eretz Israel. So, I mean, the whole process is simply giving more and more impetus to the idea that there can only be a one-state solution in the end.
Well, I've argued that since 1967, it essentially has been one apartheid state from the Jordan River to the sea,
right,
which every inch controlled by Israel. And even after Oslo, the area designed for Palestinian control was nevertheless still under Israeli authority. And the state, even a Bantustan, would end up being a disaster for the Palestinians and not any kind of solution.
Yeah, I mean, that, of course, is the reality that they're increasingly facing, is that Israel is becoming more and more like South Africa with every passing day. It is going to be ultimately impossible to hide that fact from the rest of the world, and it will inevitably suffer some very serious consequences, which, you know, we can't entirely foresee at this point, but there's no doubt that there is going to be a payment to be made for that policy.
Now, what's very distressing is, getting back to the situation of Iran, is with the election of President Obama, what anti-war movement there was, non-intervention movement there was, ceased to exist. Even the Occupy movement stayed away from foreign policy. Do you see any development of any kind of a movement on the horizon that would counter the policies that might get us into another war, supporting another war in the Middle East?
I wish I could say that I did. I would love to be able to say that I did, but I have to be quite brutally honest with myself and with you and say, no, I don't see that. I don't see any sign on the horizon of any germ of that could grow, under the present circumstances. I mean, I think it requires a set of circumstances that we do not have now and we cannot foresee at this moment, at least, that would allow for the reemergence of a real anti-war movement such as we had in 2002 in anticipation of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. There was a real movement. It was a mass movement. It was effective. It was in the streets. It represented millions of people, and it has been demobilized, and in effect, it has evaporated. It's disappeared into the woodwork. All the activists, not all, but almost all the activists who were involved in issues of war and peace have moved on to other issues. It is a sad state of affairs, which does, in fact, bother me as much or more than anything else that I can think of. I am dedicated to trying to do something about that through education. I'm trying to start a think tank, an anti-militarism think tank or anti-militarist think tank in Washington, D.C., that would be the first one to be completely dedicated to not simply opposing each individual act of war or plan for war from Washington, but to analyze and organize against the very system, the war system, that is at the root of everything that has happened over the last decade and more. That's the only thing I can think of that I can contribute to this. But it's an extremely uphill battle, pushing a very large boulder up a steep hill.
Well, Gareth Porter, we've come to the end of an abbreviated hour, and we end on kind of a depressing note. I do look forward to hearing about the formation of that think tank. I think it's really, really vital, and one that addresses the domestic problems, such as the Israel lobby has its foot on our foreign policy and intimidates both houses of Congress to the detriment of all Americans, and into the world. Anyway, thanks again for being our guest the fifth time on Takes of the World. Look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Glad to be here. Take care. Bye-bye.